Chapter 20. Westall, he stammered, reddening again. Yes. This morning. Just as I left you. Because he was tired of me. The words, uttered scarcely above a whisper, seemed to dilate to the limit of the room. Armand looked toward the door, then his embarrassed glance returned to Julia. I am very sorry, he said awkwardly. Thank you, she murmured. But I don't see, no, but you will in a moment. Won't you listen to me? Please. Instinctively as he had shifted her position, putting herself between him and the door. I it happened this morning, she went on in short breathless phrases. I never suspected anything. I thought we were perfectly happy. Suddenly he told me he was tired of me, there is a girl he likes better. He has gone to her. As she spoke, the lurking anguish rose upon her, possessing her once more to the exclusion of every other emotion. Her eyes ached, her throat swelled with it, and two painful tears burned a way down her face. Armand's constraint was increasing visibly. This is very unfortunate, he began. But I should say the law, she echoed ironically. When he asks for his freedom, you are not obliged to give it. You were not obliged to give me mine, but you did. He made a protesting gesture. You saw that the law couldn't help you, didn't you? She went on. That is what I see now. The law represents material rights it can't go beyond. If we don't recognize an inner law, the obligation that love creates. Being loved as well as loving, there is nothing to prevent our spreading ruin unhindered. Is there? She raised her head plaintively, with the look of a bewildered child. That is what I see now, what I wanted to tell you. He leaves me because he's tired, but I was not tired, and I don't understand why he is. That's the dreadful part of it, the not understanding. I hadn't realized what it meant. But I've been thinking of it all day, and things have come back to me, things I hadn't noticed. When you and I. She moved closer to him, and fixed her eyes on his with a gaze that tries to reach beyond words. I see now that you didn't understand, did you? Their eyes met in a sudden shock of comprehension. A veil seemed to be lifted between them. Armand's lip trembled. No, he said, I didn't understand. She gave a little cry, almost of triumph. I knew it. You wondered, you tried to tell me, but no words came. You saw your life falling in ruins. The world slipping from you, and you couldn't speak or move. She sank down on the chair against which as he had been leaning. And now I know, she repeated. I am very sorry for you, she heard Armand stammer. She looked up quickly. That's not what I came for. I don't want you to be sorry. I came to ask you to forgive me for not understanding that you didn't understand. That's all I wanted to say. She rose with a vague sense that the end had come and put out a groping hand toward the door. Armand stood motionless. She turned to him with a faint smile. You forgive me? There is nothing to forgive, then will you shake hands for goodbye? She felt his hand in hers. It was nerveless, reluctant. Goodbye, she repeated. I understand now. She opened the door and passed out into the hall. As she did so, Armand took an impulsive step forward. But just then the footman, who was evidently alive to his obligations, advanced from the background to let her out. She heard Armand fall back. The footman threw open the door, and she found herself outside in the darkness. The letter, for many years he had lived withdrawn from the world in which he had once played so active and even turbulent a part. The study of Tuscan art was his only pursuit, and it was to help him in the classification of his notes and documents that I was first called to his villa. Colonel Lincoln had then the look of a very old man, though his age can hardly have exceeded 70. He was small and bent, with a finely wrinkled face which still wore the tan of youthful exposure. But for this dusky redness it would have been hard to reconstruct from the shrunken recluse, with his low fastidious voice and carefully tended hands, an image of that young knight of adventure whose sword had been at the service of every uprising which stirred the uneasy soil of Italy in the first half of the 19th century. Though I was more of a proficient in Colonel Lincoln's later than his earlier pursuits, the thought of his soldiering days was always coming between me and the pacific work of his old age. As we sat collating papers and comparing photographs, I had the feeling that this dry and quiet old man had seen even stranger things than people said. That he knew more of the inner history of Europe than half the diplomatists of his day. I was not alone in this conviction, and the friend who had engaged me for Colonel Lincoln had appended to his instructions the injunction to let him to talk. But this was what no one could do. Colonel Lincoln was ready to discuss by the hour the date of a Giottesque triptych, or the attribution of a disputed master, but on the history of his early life he was habitually silent. It was perhaps because I recognized this silence, and respected it, that it afterward came to be broken for me. Or it was perhaps merely because, as the failure of Colonel Lincoln's sight cut him off from his work, he felt the natural inclination of age to revert from the empty present to the crowded past. For one cause or another he did talk to me in the last year of his life, and I felt myself mingled, to an extent inconceivable to the mere reader of history, with the passionate scenes of the Italian struggle for liberty. Colonel Lincoln had been mixed with it in all its phases. He had known the last Carbonari, and the young Italy of Mazzini. He had been in Perugia, when the mercenaries of a liberal pope slaughtered women and children in the streets. He had been in Sicily with the Thousand, and in Milan during the Cinquegiornate. They say the Italians didn't know how to fight, he said one day, musingly, that the French had to come down and do their work for them. People forget how long it was since they had had any fighting to do. But they hadn't forgotten how to suffer and hold their tongues, how to die and take their secrets with them. The Italian War of Independence was really carried on underground. It was one of those awful silent struggles which are so much more terrible than the roar of a battle. It's a deuced sight easier to charge with your regiment than to lie rotting in an Austrian prison, and know that, if you give up the name of a friend or two, you can go back scot-free to your wife and children. And thousands of Italians had the choice given them, and hardly one went back. He sat silent, his meditative fingertips laid together, his eyes fixed on the past which was the now only thing clearly visible to them. And the women? I said. Were they as brave as the men? I had not spoken quite at random. I had always heard that there had been as much of love as of war in Colonel Lincoln's early career, and I hoped that my question might give a personal turn to his reminiscences. The women, he repeated. They were braver for they had more to bear, and less to do. Italy could never have been saved without them. His eye had kindled, and I detected in it the reflection of some vivid memory. It was then that I asked him what was the bravest thing he had ever known of a woman's doing. The question was such a vague one that I hardly knew why I had put it, but to my surprise he answered almost at once, as though I had touched on a subject of frequent meditation. The bravest thing I ever saw, done by a woman, he said, was brought about by an act of my own, and one of which I am not particularly proud. For that reason I have never spoken of it before. There was a time when I didn't even care to think of it, but all that is past now. She died years ago, and so did the Jack Lincoln she knew, and in telling you the story I am no more than the mouthpiece of an old tradition which some ancestor might have handed down to me. He leaned back, his clear blind gaze fixed smilingly on me, and I had the feeling that, in groping through the labyrinth of his young adventures, I had come unawares upon their central point. 2. When I was in Milan in 47, an unlucky thing happened to me. I had been sent there to look over the ground by some of my Italian friends in England. As an English officer I had no difficulty in getting into Milanese society, for England had for years been the refuge of the Italian fugitives, and I was known to be working in their interests. It was just the kind of job I liked, and I never enjoyed life more than I did in those days. There was a great deal going on, good music, balls and theaters. Milan kept up her gaiety to the last. The English were shocked by the insouciance of a race who could dance under the very nose of the usurper, but those who understood the situation knew that Milan was playing Brutus, and playing it uncommonly well. I was in the thick of it all. It was just the atmosphere, to suit a young fellow of 29, with a healthy passion for waltzing and fighting. But, as I said, an unlucky thing happened to me. I was fool enough to fall in love with Donna Candida Falco. You have heard of her, of course. You know the share she had in the great work. In a different way, she was what the terrible Princess Bulgioioso had been to an earlier generation. But Donna Candida was not terrible. She was quiet, discreet and charming. When I knew her, she was a widow of 30, her husband, Andrea Falco, having died 10 years previously, soon after their marriage. The marriage had been notoriously unhappy, and his death was a release to Donna Candida. Her family were of Medina, but they had come to live in Milan soon after the execution of Ciro Menotti and his companions. You remember the details of that business? The Duke of Medina, one of the most adroit villains in Europe, had been bitten with the hope of uniting the Italian states under his rule. It was a vision of Italian liberation of a sort. A few madmen were dazzled by it, and Ciro Menotti was one of them. You know the end. The Duke of Medina, who had counted on Louis Philippe's backing, found that astute sovereign had betrayed him to Austria. Instantly, he saw that his first business was to get rid of the conspirators he had created. There was nothing easier than for a Habsburgist to turn on a friend. Ciro Menotti had staked his life for the Duke, and the Duke took it. You may remember that, on the night when 700 men and a cannon attacked Menotti's house, the Duke was seen looking on at the slaughter from an arcade across the square. Well, among the lesser fry taken that night was a lad of 18, Emilio Verna, who was the only brother of Donna Candida. The Verna family was one of the most respected in Medina. It consisted, at that time, of the mother, Countess Verna, of young Emilio and his sister. Count Verna had been in Spielberg in the 20s. He had never recovered from his sufferings there, and died in exile, without seeing his wife and children again. Countess Verna had been an ardent patriot in her youth, but the failure of the first attempts against Austria had discouraged her. She thought that in losing her husband she had sacrificed enough for her country, and her one idea was to keep Emilio on good terms with the government. But the Verna blood was not tractable, and his father's death was not likely to make Emilio a good subject of the East. Not that he had as yet taken any active share in the work of the conspirators. He simply hadn't had time. At his trial there was nothing to show that he had been in Menotti's confidence, but he had been seen once or twice coming out of what the Dusel police called suspicious houses, and in his desk were found some verses to Italy. That was enough to hang a man in Medina, and Emilio Verna was hanged. The Countess never recovered from the blow. The circumstances of her son's death were too abominable, too unendurable. If he had risked his life in the conspiracy, she might have been reconciled to his losing it. But he was a mere child, who had sat at home, chafing but powerless, while his seniors plotted and fought. He had been sacrificed to the Duke's insane fear, to his savage greed for victims, and the Countess Verna was not to be consoled. As soon as possible, the mother and daughter left Medina for Milan. There they lived in seclusion till Candida's marriage. During her girlhood she had had to accept her mother's view of life, to shut herself up in the tomb in which the poor woman brooded over her martyrs. But that was not the girl's way of honoring the dead. At the moment when the first shot was fired on Menotti's house, he had been reading Petrarch's Ode to the Lords of Italy, and the lines Lantico valor ne vitalicae cor non ne anchor morto had lodged like a bullet in her brain. From the day of her marriage she began to take a share in the silent work which was going on throughout Italy. Milan was at that time the center of the movement, and Candida Falco threw herself into it with all the passion which her unhappy marriage left unsatisfied. At first he had to act with great reserve, for her husband, and was a prudent man, who did not care to have his habits disturbed by political complications. But after his death there was nothing to restrain her, except the exquisite tact which enabled her to work night and day in the Italian cause without giving the Austrian authorities a pretext for interference. When I first knew Donna Candida, her mother was still living. A tragic woman, prematurely bowed, like an image of death in the background of the daughter's brilliant life. The Countess, since her son's death, had become a patriot again, though in a narrower sense than Candida. The mother's first thought was that her dead must be avenged, the daughter's that Italy must be saved. But from different motives they worked for the same end. Candida felt for the Countess. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.